The Neil Prendeville Show. Weekdays from 9 a.m. 104 to 106. Red FM.
Much obliged for your calls and comments. We'll come back to them, I promise you that. Also, keep on texting with regards to two things. It's almost like a two-edged sword. Your favorite Bond movie and your favorite Bond song. All right, we'll come back to that. That's by text to 086-8104-106. I promised you yesterday that I would do my best to talk to David McWilliams this morning. I've delivered on my promise, as he has. The Irish economist, writer, broadcaster and journalist joins me by phone for a few minutes. David, good morning.
Neil, good morning to you.
It's been a while since we...
It has been a while. How are you?
I'm very good. I always look forward to chatting with you because you're so matter of fact and you're usually right on the money. Here, ladies and gentlemen, is the guy who was saying all those years ago, hold on, this is all going to end in tears. But anyway, I wanted to just mention to you off the bat, do you have any thoughts on the Taoiseach and the calling out the guards and the army to protect ATMs and banks when Greece was going tits up?
I tell you what, I was away until last night, and I only heard about it really through the vine, through Twitter, whatever. Did he say last night he didn't call out the guards, was it?
He's kind of denying the context in which it's being reported in the media. He's saying he didn't say at some meeting in Madrid that they were about to call out the army to guard the ATMs and Irish banks. What he said was there was talk with the central bank about whether we might need them if there was a rush on the banks.
Well, I mean, I think what's happening now, the Taoiseach does seem to be, meeting a lot of men and, musing out loud. And so I met a lad now who said such and such, and I met a woman who said such and such. And I suppose, in the overall scheme of things, he's using sort of anecdote to try and underscore the severity of a situation 3 or 4 years ago, which was severe. Mm. So there'll be a lot of journalists are very po-faced about these things. And they say, I can't believe that he said, a lot of things, that, whether it's himself or other people say, in the course of conversation can be taken out. I think out of place. I tend to be, as you know, Neil, a more forgiving person than most. People do say things like that, and it's to try and add, I presume he was trying to suggest
that it could have been that bad.
That when a country runs out of money, which we could have done, that what you would get is a bank run. And what you get is in a bank run, you can imagine this, you're in a queue at an ATM in Patrick Street in Cork, and the reason you're at a queue is you don't think there's enough money in the ATM. Okay? Therefore, the fella in front of you doesn't become a friend. He becomes an enemy.
Yeah.
Just think about it, the way crowd dynamics work.
Yeah, the bank teller behind the counter who won't give you your money is also the enemy.
Becomes the enemy, right? So, the reason there is a bank run, if you think about it, Neil, it's because you think there isn't enough money in the machine. So the only way you stop a bank run is the state has to convince everybody that there is enough money in the machine. And that if you come back in an hour or two later, you'll still get your 100 euros or your 200 euros. So I think, I'm always more forgiving on these sort of anecdotes and analogies that people use at a time. But I just think that if you're the Taoiseach, you'd want to be more careful about what you say. And if you didn't have those conversations, right?
Yeah.
And if you're totally spoofing, okay, then you should actually fess up and say, look, you know what, this was only a turn of phrase or a matter of speech, rather than let the whole thing play out to a press conference yesterday, wasn't it?
Or something like that. Yeah. No, I mean, it could quite, I'm not an economist by any stretch of the imagination.
Look at you.
But it could have happened.
Of course. This is the thing, is that what you find very interesting about economic crises, if you look at them around the world, is that on the eve of the crises, people rarely think it's going to get as bad as it does, which is why it's a crisis. If it didn't get as bad as it did, it wouldn't be a crisis. It would just be an issue or an event. What could happen and what might happen is a situation which actually happened in Greece, where there was a 65 euro a day minimum, maximum
withdrawal,
based on people withdrawing. And that was exactly because the money was leaving the country in billions. And in actual fact, the same thing was actually happening here. The money was leaving the country in billions. I think we spoke about it during the period. So again, I think it's maybe his idea is to underscore the severity of when things do go out of control, they go out of control.
And where do you think we're at now? Everybody is yet again preoccupied with property prices.
Oh, yeah.
And you were speculating in the Indo yesterday on this.
Well, I'm always in, look, the property price weakness in Ireland is something that I think you, me, all your listeners, it's a sort of a guilty pleasure, really. Because on the one hand, in civilized company, we all say, oh, I can't believe that's happening. Oh, my good God, you know, were we so stupid again? And then we find ourselves leafing through or flicking through the property pages of the, as I always call it, pornography for the middle class, you know, of property pages. So, but, you know, what I was writing about in the Indo yesterday was how actually property prices rise and what they do to people's heads when it happens. I mean, and what I was making the point was that traditional economists, the mainstream economists, the fellows that you had on maybe a few years ago telling you everything will be grand or there'll be a soft landing, make this fundamental mistake, which is they think that when the price of property goes up, the demand goes down. And you'll hear them say that on prime time and on TV and on radio all the time, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But actually, Neil, that's not what actually happens. In Ireland, when the price of property goes up, something strange happens to people. Those people who want property, maybe those trying to get on the ladder or first-time buyers, they panic when they see prices rising. So if prices are going up by 10%, demand actually goes up. It doesn't go down. And the reason is that people panic and they say, Jesus, I better bring forward my purchase now, because otherwise if I delay a wee bit longer, I'm going to end up paying more.
Mm.
So that's when they start calling up their parents and start ringing around and looking down the back of the couch to get deposits and all that sort of stuff, right?
The 20%, the dreaded 20%.
So when the prices goes up, actually happens is younger people panic and demand doesn't go down, as economists say, it actually goes up.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, if you think around what happens to the supply of property, economists come on the TV and they say, well, when the price goes up, the supply will also go up. But is that actually what happens?
No, not if people who own the land hold back.
People who own the land hold back. You look all around Cork City, right? You look all around Cork City, particularly the older, more mature suburbs of Cork, the Bishopstowns of this world or whatever, they are still probably populated with people who bought those houses in the 1960s when they were built. And they're getting on. I talked to my own mother about this, who bought our house in the 1960s as well. And she's getting on. She's still in a four-bedroom house on her own. And she would say to me, if the prices of property are going up, everyone says, well, Mum, maybe you should move. You should trade down and move into a flat. And she says, well, hold on, David. If the price of property is going up by 10%, wouldn't I be mad to sell today?
Yeah.
When I can sell next year and make it a little bit more. And that's just human nature. So what I'm saying in the piece is that expectations about where prices go play the dominant role in our behavior. That's the key thing to understand. And then we've got to realize this. Why do expectations change about future prices? And they change largely because of the way in which the banks lend against property. And they also change largely because of the way in which auctioneers value property. So an auctioneer in Cork will value a property today based on the last market price, yesterday's price.
Yeah.
Now, if yesterday's price is out of whack with the long-term value of the property, what happens is you tend to get valuations and auctioneers amplifying the rush of credit that goes into the market, which therefore amplifies the expectations, which change people's behavior. And that, I believe, is a problem. So we need to change the way we value property, and that will change the amount of credit that the banks prudently think they can lend, and that will change this expectation cycle, which will actually help people to make more prudent decisions about property than is the case at the moment.
It's very confusing, though, because I have two photocopies here, both from papers yesterday. One is from The Independent, which you write in, property prices still rising, and the other is from the Irish Mirror from yesterday, house prices slow down. You know,
yes.
It depends on what day and what paper you pick up.
Well, isn't this, well, you see, this is the beautiful thing, and you've actually pointed out, right, that basically in the last year and a half since the central bank introduced those guidelines, there has been a cooling off in the property market. There's no doubt of that.
Because people can't get the deposit together.
Because they can't get the deposit together, so prices eventually begin the process of coming down. Okay? Or worse still, they don't rise as quick as we thought they were going to do, which is probably more accurate. Okay?
Yeah.
But if you take that over a year, you can still say, well, prices, you know, over the last year did rise by 10%. Okay? Whereas if you take the last month, you'll say the prices may well be flattening out in certain areas. But in general, we still have, Neil, and this is the key, we still have a shortage of houses.
Everywhere?
And everywhere. Well, you know, everywhere that matters. And when I say matters, that matters because people want to live there. Okay? There is no point in having buckets of houses in Leitrim or Roscommon.
Mm.
Because, although people in Leitrim or Roscommon might disagree, I'm sure they would.
You claim nobody wants to live there.
I don't claim it. The facts are, we're not seeing people queuing up in Carrick and Shannon to buy houses.
So
that's where it is. It's houses being the right place at the right time, at the right price for the right people.
Is it not the case that developers are keen and anxious to build more housing estates in suburban and metropolis areas, though? I've heard somewhere this morning say, for instance, that Michael O'Flynn wants to get stuck in and build thousands of houses again.
Well, you see, this is one of the strange fallouts from NAMA and the whole crisis. We started the conversation about the army and the ATMs at the height of the crisis. Is that when most of the developers' land was transferred to NAMA, NAMA has gone and sold most of the prime properties now, not to developers but to investors.
Are they overseas? Or are they here? Or?
Mainly foreigners.
Right.
Mainly
like foreigners. Where? Were they Chinese? Russian?
American in the main.
Right.
American in the main. Now, of course, the American foreigners, although they have been branded, or not branded, they have been marketed as the great saviors of Ireland, right? Because they came in at a time when there was no money. They have this, what they call the 3-3-30 rule, Neil, okay?
Right, what's that?
The first is they invest for 3 years. They only invest 3% of their total portfolio in any one country. And they want 30% return, and then they sell.
They want 30% profit after 3 years.
For 3 years. And that country, whether it's Ireland or Poland or whatever, can only constitute 3% of their total risk, okay?
Right, right.
So they're American multinational funds that invest everywhere. So think about this, 3-3-30, right? Now, what is happening to those guys is they might have bought the land last year, okay? They are banking that land, and they are not selling it to Irish developers because they want to make their 30%, or even if they can make more, they will make more. So what you're finding is the owners of land are not actually the people who have the competence in building on the land.
Yeah.
The developers.
They're speculative. Have they also bought hotel chains? Have they also bought office portfolios?
You walk into most hotels, many hotels in Ireland. I would say most hotels built in the period 2000 to 2006 are now in the hands of people who didn't build them and didn't own them in the first place.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're not operators either. Yeah.
They're not operators.
Yeah.
What they are, they're fellas with spreadsheets. Right? And you even notice that because, I mean, I travel around quite a bit and spend a lot of time away from home in Ireland. And you notice it even in the hotels you stay in. You know the ones that are run by fellas with spreadsheets, and you know the ones that are run by real hoteliers.
Mm.
You know that straight away.
Mm.
It's a totally different feel. And again, what the spreadsheet guys are doing is they're accountants, little targets who don't really understand the hospitality industry, and they again are waiting to sell, a trigger to sell. So the implication, Neil, it means that there may well be a cascade of properties coming onto the market in a number of years.
But if all of those have been doing this for a number of years now, surely that 3-year rule has already kicked in and they've been off.
Yeah, they're beginning to sell. You see that certainly in Dublin. In the big, you know, the swankier parts of Dublin where you have the really kind of the glittering prizes of the Celtic Tiger, as I say.
Yeah.
The glass and chrome and steel pieces and the big buildings down at the Docklands. They're beginning to change hands now. But, you know, you have to understand that this is a sort of a tsunami that begins in Dublin, and it takes time to actually work its way out first to Cork City and then out to Cork County and around. It'll take time.
I think property actually came. Did it drop 35-40% on the peak? Isn't it? Is that a good?
I think even more. I think about half.
50% even.
Yeah.
Of course, we'll never see those days again, will we?
Well, I don't know, Neil. You know, the funniest thing is that you should never say never in any game. I wouldn't like it. You know, like, again, it comes back to this idea. You know, what as an economist, I think we should do is one thing. What we actually do is possibly more interesting to discuss because, in actual fact, it's the reality of life for people listening to the show.
Mm.
Okay? And You know, the interesting thing about human nature, Neil, is we never learn, ever, about anything. This is a really interesting thing, you know. When you listen to people say, well, there has been, they went through that experience, it was traumatic, my God, they're going to change their behavior and they'll never do that again. That's actually not what happens. Humans are hardwired to be optimists about the future. This is why I think we're the most successful animal in the world.
But they say we're the, they say Ireland is the poster boy of Europe, or the fastest growing economy in the civilized world. Or, is that nonsense?
We're not. Look, on the figures, look, the first thing to understand is we're not a European economy. Okay? Right?
Well, we export an awful lot more than we import. That's got
to
be
look,
good.
We export it all to Britain and America. We are basically part of the Anglo-American world. We're an Atlantic economy. You know, largely, almost 100% English speaking. Our entire legal system, our cultural ties, our historic ties are with America, Britain, and Canada.
Yeah, so mind them
Europe.
Then. Yeah.
Don't mind this French malarkey. You know, we've nothing in common with the French and the Germans, right? When fellows from Cork, do you remember the Dagenham Yanks? Did you ever hear of them?
Yes.
Because my mother's from Cork, and she used to tell me the Dagenham Yanks come in. They came from Dagenham. Cork fellows went to Dagenham to work. They didn't go to Dresden. They weren't the Dresden Yanks swanning around Patrick Street, okay? The links between Ireland and Britain and Ireland and America and Ireland and Canada, I was in Canada last week and it's amazing, are so deep and so strong. We do all our trade with these people. Our kids are going, 10,000 Irish kids took up visas to Toronto, to Canada last year. They don't go to Italy or Spain. So the idea that we're a European economy is this sort of a notional thing that the Department of Finance likes to pretend we are, and they issue publications and run journalists take up that language, but in reality we're not. So the reason we're doing well is Britain and America are also doing well and have been doing well for the last 4 years. American unemployment is 5%, Britain's at 5%. These are countries
we're close to. We're going to be close to 9, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, our problem in Ireland is we tolerate levels of unemployment that are twice that of our trading partners, and we call it a success.
But how do you not tolerate it? Like, I mean, if there was an easy way to create jobs.
Well, I think that we have massive deficient demand in Ireland. I think that if you have unemployment rates that are twice the rates of your trading partners, your main trading partners, people that you actually do business with, then there is enormous capacity for the economy to expand still, without any fear of overheating, any fear of inflation. And that's what annoys me about the discussion in the last week on the budget, Neil, that economist after economist came on the telly and said, oh, we're, you know, the expansion is being threatened. We are overheating. That's complete nonsense. Overheating is when you've no people available to go to work. We have hundreds of thousands of people available to go to work in this country. So we should expand the economy and should drive demand more and more until we get to a position.
But
and this is the key, because, you know, it's all very well, if you're in a job, right, like you and me are, it's very easy to say, oh, the country's overheating, right? If you're out of a job, you think of the world in a totally different way.
You do, of course. You do, of course, like having money and not having it. It's a completely different world for each another. So, but, I wonder,
people are coming on TV saying we're overheating are probably on very nice salaries and have concerns that are not to do with losing their job.
But those that are looking for work and where it's available to them, it doesn't pay them to take it up. It pays that badly.
Well, in certain cases, Neil. In certain cases. I'm just saying that, you know, when I look at a country like Ireland and I look at the rate of unemployment, I still think it's actually criminal to be talking about overheating and to be talking about worried about the expansion.
Yeah, it's disrespectful, I suppose, yeah.
Well, it's a total insult to hundreds of thousands of people. And so, you know, when you spend time, I said I was in Canada the other day, I was in the States as well, you know, you listen to Americans and Canadians, the way they talk about the economy, and they would not tolerate a conversation about overheating or worried about the economy spilling over or getting too hot until the rate of unemployment is down about 5%.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way they think, and we should think the same way.
Yeah. Finally, what about those that want to get, I know I'm back to housing again, but say young people who want to get on the housing ladder and want to have a house and want to have a child, but just, do you think that 20% cap or necessity for deposit, is that a good idea or has it screwed things up?
Well, I think like a lot of good ideas, it's very good in the long run, okay, but very, very difficult in the short run for people who are actually being affected by it. And by that I mean that over time it's probably a good thing to to try and limit the amount of credit that goes into the housing market, because that'll limit the increase in prices. That's fair enough, right?
Yeah, but they could afford the mortgage, but they can't afford the deposit.
Well, that's the thing. And then what you do end up in a situation is the already wealthy, whose mum and dad can give them, you know, 20 grand, okay, they end up elbowing their way to the top of the queue.
Yeah.
And those whose parents don't have the money will find themselves at the bottom. And
yeah.
I think that's really what you're seeing now. You're seeing,
because of the 20%.
But you're seeing the sort of social impact of an arbitrary number.
It's an interesting stat, actually, I have for you. If you look at, say, January up until the last available figure, which is January-August, in 2013, 16,500 transactions, buying and selling houses, took place. That was 16,500.
Yeah.
In 2014, 23,500. And so far to date, 30,000. You see that increase? 16,500, 23,500 to 30. So they're selling.
They are selling, but who's buying them?
No.
That's the key.
Yeah, you think it's speculators and landlords.
I think what it is is that it's largely middle-aged people who are getting 0% on deposits in the banks and have begun to get a little bit more confident about the country. And they are moving in, and they want to be landlords.
Yeah.
And the whole idea is they want, even though nobody says this, but you've got to, I suppose, people like me, our job is to stand back and look at it. The new landlords want to turn the would-be first-time buyers into long-term tenants, because that's the only way in which the new landlords will get a stream of income, which is constant, coming in to make legitimate their investment. Do you understand?
We're preoccupied at the same time with owning our own house.
Well, what you're having is a generational shift again, where the new landlords, and again, it's entirely logical, are saying to themselves, you know, I have money in the bank. I had it through in the crisis. You know, there's over 90 billion on deposit in this country. It's a lot of money.
Is that high? Is that a high figure by virtue of history?
It's high by a variety of standards.
Is it a historical high then?
I think, you know, I'd be spoofing to say I knew exactly what the historical high was, but it's a very high figure. It may well have been higher at some stage in the boom.
Yeah.
It may well have been, but it's a lot of money. If you think about the GDP of the country, the whole income of the country is only about 140 billion.
90
so
billion.
That means, you know, a substantial amount of GDP is on deposit.
So banks are cash rich then?
They are totally cash rich.
Yeah.
And yet they are very selective in who they lend to.
Yeah. Yeah, are you going to be figuring these issues at your Kilconomics in Kilkenny?
You have to come to Kilconomics, right? You have to come to. You know, we started the discussion about the ATMs and banks running out of money. We're going to, and that maybe happened in Greece. We have the former Greek finance minister Varoufakis, our friend with the leather jacket,
the biker,
the biker. Yeah, he's coming. He's
no helmet.
No helmet. Exactly. We have probably the finest economic mind in the world, Nissan Taleb, is coming in. We have 52 events over 4 days. We're going to be teasing out all these issues. Kilconomics.com. It's a really, you know, not because I'm involved in it, it's a really special, interesting festival where we have stand-up comedians, the likes of Des Bishop, asking the questions to, you know, Nobel or soon-to-be Nobel Prize-winning economists. It works amazingly well. We do it in the cathedral in Kilkenny. We do it in little pubs. We do it in theatres. We do it in the... And it's, you know, it spills out onto the street. It's a mad, wonderful festival that works brilliantly. And it begins next Thursday week.
This day week until up to and including Sunday.
Sunday at
kilkenny.com. I'll give details of that.
You better plug this like hell.
I'll plug it like crazy. But when you're doing the next one, do it in Cork. Do you know, finally,
I'd love to do it in Cork.
Yeah, because we have, you know, hopefully sooner or later we'll have a convention centre down here if they ever get to turn the sod on it, but we'll have to wait.
Oh, I've heard all about it. Don't worry. I had a taxi driver down the Mardyke giving out yards about it.
Taxi drivers know everything. Do you know, finally, I think the greatest disservice that I ever saw was the budget and the paltry amount that was given to pensioners by comparison to everybody else. You know, €3 a week wouldn't buy them a chicken. You know?
Certainly wouldn't buy them a chicken.
You know, for the hardest working all of their life, I thought it was a derisory insult to the aged.
It's also very unusual. I would have thought that a government that, you know, is very sensitive to an election, which they're coming, I mean, I presume it's next year sometime, early spring or something, would have been much more political in what they did.
Yeah.
I was very, but it is true that, you know, what you find is that in Ireland, you know, the poorest people are the youngest and the oldest.
Yeah, but the oldest vote most.
Yeah, the oldest vote most. But I mean, it is, and then we should never get away from that fact that while there are a lot of pensioners who've done well and squirreled money aside over the years, and really saved for the rainy day and they've built up a nest egg, there are a huge amount of people who didn't and couldn't afford to, and now are very much at the most vulnerable stage in their lives.
Correct, yeah. I was talking to a guy two weeks ago at the time of the budget. I think it was a Tuesday. He was going to stay in bed until the Thursday till he got his pension. He had no money for fuel and he had no food, and the best place was warm in bed.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we'd all think that, you know, when you're reasonably robust and can work and go out and earn a crust, you know, the one thing we know about old age is the only thing that happens to all of us. That's what we know, right? Mm. If we're lucky enough, you know, to live healthily, great. But we know that we all get old. That's the one thing that humans do. And all of us would hope, I think, that if you reach that stage where you can't earn a wage and you can't earn a crust, that you'd have a state that you've contributed to for 100, you know, all your life.
Here's another thing, you economics. I'll let you go now. But here's
you
another,
economics types.
Yeah, need to start looking at. People are living longer. Children are born now who will live to 100 years, 150 years of age. Somebody said to me the weekend, it won't be long before a person could live to 1,000. Can you imagine the strain on the health and welfare system if people are living that long?
I mean, the aging of the population is the huge imponderable. You know, when I look at my own kids, who are now in their early teens, it's very likely that they will live till 100.
Correct, yeah. You know? I don't know what quality of life they'll have or how sick they will be, but the strain on the economy to keep them healthy...
The strain on me having them now is enormous.
That's right, yeah. Well, you're one of these dads who used to have cash in your wallet, now you just keep photographs.
You're very right.
All right, well, good luck with Kilkenomics. The next one, hopefully, will be Corkonomics, and we'll look forward to that as well.
Pleasure.
Cheers, David. Take care. Bye-bye. David McWilliams has the Irish Economics Festival called Kilkenomics happening in Kilkenny this day week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday of next week. It's their biggest yet. The sixth edition brings together some of the world's leading economists, financial analysts, media commentators, some of the funniest, sharpest stand-up comedians, amongst them the great Des Bishop, who we claim as our own. Further details at kilkenomics.com.
The Neil Prendeville Show. Weekdays from 9 a.m., 104 to 106, Red FM.